You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 22nd, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Aline Brown on her series in The Intercept, highlighting the severe climate risks in detention facilities called Climate and Punishment, and Jack Crosby of our very own AM Quickie newsletter and writer will be joining us later, who is in Ukraine, on Russia's dramatic escalation. Meanwhile, Russia has escalated its aggressive posture towards Ukraine. Yesterday, Putin ordered troops into two separatist territories in Ukraine, a violation of international law, and proclaimed that they are independent states while also denying the existence of Ukraine's sovereignty. On Monday night, the Biden administration responded by issuing sanctions by executive order targeting the separatist regions. More sanctions are likely to come today. But Republicans and Democrats like Bob Menendez are calling for, quote, crushing sanctions on Russia. In addition, Republicans in particular keep mentioning cutting off the Nord Stream pipeline. So wonder what interests they may have there. Speaking of Nord Stream, Germany has halted certification of the pipeline, which runs from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Sea. Saudi Arabia is loving that. All three of Ahmaud Arbery's murderers were found guilty of a federal hate crime statute this morning, meaning they now face an additional life sentence with these federal charges, convictions, I should say, after being convicted on state charges earlier this year. Colombia has decriminalized abortion after years of organizing by women in Latin America. Now, three of the four most populous nations in Latin America allow abortion. Indigenous nations in North Dakota are suing the state over racialized gerrymandering after the newly drawn House maps groups indigenous voters into one House district. And lastly, some good news. Iran and the U.S. seem to be nearing a new nuclear peace agreement. Fingers crossed on that one. All this and more on today's program. That would be massive, as we're talking about war right now. A peace agreement seems like some sort of reprieve, especially because Obama arguably might have been the best thing he did as president, negotiating that peace agreement with Iran.
Yeah, that's a good use of the State Department. I mean, yep. There's plenty of reasons to distrust the State Department, but that is a good use of it, and we should see more of that.
More diplomacy and never closing a diplomatic door, including right now with what's going on with Ukraine. I guess we can just dive right into that. So yesterday was not the day to dive into the complexities of the Cold War rebuild and Ukraine's NATO admission as a potential deterrent to Russia, given what happened after the show, because Vladimir Putin really escalated things. And my sense was things were drawing down. The chest puffing had either plateaued or peaked. Saber rattling, if you will. Not the case. Putin took it to another level last night. And I'll be frank and say that it made me rethink what I now perceive as a blind spot of my own in that story, which is the sincerity and intensity of Putin's USSR reunion rhetoric. In fact, I think my emphasis was poorly timed, honestly, just given what broke after the show yesterday. So I'll get to that in a second. But what happened yesterday is that Vladimir Putin dramatically escalated this conflict despite the fact that going into the weekend, as I mentioned, things appeared like things were just de-escalating. Macron had brokered or said he had brokered some sort of talk between Putin and Biden. But then yesterday afternoon, here at least, last night in Russia, Putin scrapped all of that and gave this rambling speech that was clearly laying out his nationalist intentions and really imperialist intentions. Yesterday, it appears he's moving even closer in the direction of acting on his desires. He declared two separatist regions of Ukraine as a part of Russia, Luhansk and Donetsk. Sorry if I butchered that. This is an escalation because since 2014, there have been conflicts in those regions with the separatists, and it's been bloody since 2014. And now Putin is ramping that up even further. Here he is doing so in his speech yesterday.
В этой связи считаю необходимым принять уже давно назревшее решение. Незамедлительно признать независимость и суверенитет Донецкой Народной Республики и Луганской Народной Республики. Прошу Федеральное собрание Российской Федерации поддержать это решение, а затем и ратифицировать договоры о дружбе и взаимопомощи, кто захватил и удерживает власть в Киеве. Мы требуем незамедлительно прекратить боевые действия. В противном случае вся ответственность за возможное продолжение кровопролития будет целиком и полностью на совести правящего на территории Украины режима.
So he's absolving himself of all responsibility for any continuation of bloodshed and putting that all on Ukraine if they do not recognize the territories that are technically within their maps as a part of Russia. So this is a clear provocation at the very least. Now, these separatist regions have declared themselves as independent. That's a separate conversation because now he's talking about moving troops into these regions. And he claims ridiculously that they're peacekeeping troops. That in and of itself is a provocation because it inflames tensions in these separatist regions and increases the likelihood of violence, even if, say, troops are not deployed. But now we're talking about troops being deployed, and that's imperialism. And you got to call it for what it is. So Putin, in that speech, also denied Ukraine's sovereignty and history fairly broadly, claiming it was entirely created by Russia, claiming Ukraine was trying to get nuclear weapons, which is lunacy, totally false, but it is very much in keeping with his ideology that he seems to be increasingly actualizing, which is the return of the USSR. He was born of that political period. It has been a part of his political identity, even though his speech was also very anti-communist, we should point out as well. He just wants to exert strength, and that is what his nationalism entails, including his imperialist tendencies as well. He also talked about in the speech the corruption of the Ukrainian government and the pro-Western money that has flowed into Ukraine in order to maintain a nationalist posture against Russia, which is true. That has happened. But Putin making a claim about corruption as a pretext for invasion and denying the sovereignty of a nation is pretty rich, given his own relationship with oligarchs and the consolidation of power of those oligarchs in Russia. Matt, did you want to say something?
Oh, I mean, I got a couple of things to dive in with when you're finished.
Okay. No, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, like, you know, we mentioned this a little bit yesterday. I would read double my recommendation of the American Prestige podcast with Derek Davis and Daniel Bessner, where they mentioned this weekend that, look, like, the dismissal of the capacity for an quote-unquote invasion was dismissing a full invasion of, like, sort of Kiev and stuff. And these regions, I think, like Davison said, like, I think the left kind of did overlook the possibility for Putin to, like, have acts of aggression, frankly, right?
Yeah.
Like, but I also want to put, I don't think there should be an overcorrection here. I don't think right. Like, I think anti-war posture is still the proper one. I mean, Daniel Bessner tweeted this out yesterday. Seeing some people criticize the supposed tendency on the quote left to attribute every bad action to the U.S. The proper left position is to ask why the assumption is that the U.S. should have a role to play in areas of the world around issues of no importance to U.S. interests. It seems like the default position of many good people is that the U.S. should do quote good things abroad, which in this case seems preventing invasion of Ukraine, and not doing quote bad things. Of course, to do good and bad things, one needs incredible military capabilities, and also the U.S. must maintain its hegemonic position. And so these are the things that are just assumed, right? When we have these conversations, I think these are the important things to not think about. And Bessner continues saying, some see criticism of this tweet, basically argue that it suggests a betrayal of the project of left international, right? Like, we're not being international if we don't call out Putin equally as our own country. But Bessner says, want to say a few things. In an ideal world, there would be a left international project. There isn't one right now, or at least capable of shaping the world in any real way. Given that I situate myself as a U.S. citizen writing within the U.S. and ultimately to the U.S. public policymaking elite, we live in a world of nation states, regardless of what we may desire. And I take that as a foundation of my politics. I think the fundamental lesson of historical materialism is to appreciate your moment and the power constellations within it. So, like, I think... sort of a lesson learned with regards to not like foreclosing any capacity for other countries to be bad actors. But I also think like no war with Russia over this.
Yeah. I'm not trying to overcorrect. I'm just, I think that there was a healthy mistrust of what the United States was saying publicly about this.
I mean, we just invaded multiple countries. Like, we just stole money from the Afghan treasury. Like, right? Like, this skepticism is absolutely
wrong. And what I said about the money that the United States poured into Ukraine with these groups is true. I mean, and we supported that. And so that is important context, but it was a, you know, unfortunate timing in that way, because I maybe naively did not perceive that Putin was going to escalate it to this degree. So I don't want to overcorrect, but I'm also just like a real fan of holding myself accountable a bit.
No, fair enough. And I would say just regards to like what I would like to see done in case, like, let's say Putin expands and does like invade even like all of Ukraine. I still don't think we should like counter invade. I think it'd be like a Berlin Airlift situation where we help people where we can, right? Like, yeah. Those sorts of international responses to aggressors is what we should be coordinating. Unfortunately, like, we don't have a desire to strongly coordinate that stuff, because if the international community could come together to stop aggressors, they would have stopped us from invading Iraq.
Right.
But anyway.
Yeah. And Bessner is someone who I've listened to and read about this before. He's a great source if people want to look up his Twitter feed.
And him and Dave, Derek are completely like transparent about this stuff. And like you, Emma, they are all for holding themselves accountable. So,
yeah. So again, that I think there were a lot of left voices who were saying similar stuff to me. And you know, there's also probably an inherent Americentrism in the way that some on the left are viewing this, because it's almost the inverse of the way that Republicans and conservatives do this, because as children growing up during the Iraq War era, a lot of the way that we view imperialism is through a United States context. And that can, and even with Putin's aggression in and of itself, he's become such a like meme in the United States that sometimes one ear and out the other to a certain degree, what he was talking about. So I still stand by that Bush's decision to scrap an agreement on Ukraine, not joining NATO was insane and rubbed salt in a wound of an already intense situation and and exacerbated it. I do believe a lack of reconstruction after the dissolution of the Soviet Union contributed to where we are today, which is a place where an authoritarian, a nationalist, an imperialist like Putin has cemented power in this and is now exercising it on a bordering country. And that is terrifying. So my default position will always be to mistrust saber rattling from the United States and what's coming out of our intelligence services. And I think that should be what our audience does as well. It's going to be more successful more times than not. But in terms of more sanctions, Republicans and hawkish Democrats like Menendez are seeing blood in the water right now. I am in favor of imposing sanctions that are targeted on Russian elites. right now, the sanctions that the Biden administration is imposing. See, we're recording this, what, it's 12:18 p.m. right now. He's going to announce more sanctions today, but it seems to also be targeting investors and high-profile individuals in the separatist regions. We'll see what else comes of it. But, you know, Bob Menendez was quoted in, I believe, Politico today, calling for, quote, crushing sanctions. I'm not in favor of sanctions that affect the Russian people. And often that's what sanctions do. So I think the Biden administration is less worried in regards to how sanctions are going to affect the Russian people and more worried that cutting off Russia to that degree is going to drive them into the arms of China, which is the number one concern of hawks in this country, Chinese hegemony. And given the state of U.S. empire and their investment in maintaining it, I think that that's a fair fear. But for now, we'll see. This is an evolving story, but just wanted to make clear, avoiding war at all costs is the position of this show and is my position as well. And that's where we're at. All right, folks, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Aline Brown to talk about her series in The Intercept, Climate and Punishment. And we are joined by Aline Brown on her series in The Intercept called Climate and Punishment, about the insane and scary climate risks in detention facilities. Aline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, I mean, let's just put up, if we could, Bradley, her series in The Intercept here. This is a three-part series, unless there are more to come, but potentially...
Yeah. I mean, we see this as an ongoing series, so we'll continue to add stories to this as the season goes on, I think.
So here we have it. It's called Climate and Punishment. And is it up? Okay. Yeah. And it's three parts as of right now: Boiling Behind Bars, Dark Smoky Cells, Trapped in the Floods. I'd recommend everybody check it out, but we'll talk a little bit about all three parts that are up right now. Today, it's incredibly well done, and the visuals in the story that you won't be able to see when we're chatting about this are excellent as well. So I guess let's start first with a big picture question. What inspired you to write this series, and kind of what really gave you the tip off that this was going to be your focus, that people who are incarcerated in this country are going to be bearing the brunt of climate change to this insane degree?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say, as a reporter that often is covering climate-related issues, I'm always thinking about who is the most vulnerable to the like myriad problems that the climate crisis creates. So, you know, I was really thinking about, you know, I think the spring or summer was coming and thinking about these disasters that, were likely to come and how I was going to cover them. So wildfires, hurricanes. And again, I thought about who was the most vulnerable and how we could tell their story in a meaningful way. I also started talking to my colleague, Akil Harris, who is really my co-reporter on this, and is a developer. He's our newsroom researcher and developer. And so he sort of had the skills to create this big picture data project that would allow anyone to find out how any facility might be impacted by climate risk.
So we can start, I guess, with a very recent example of how the wildfires in California affected the prison population there. The Dark Stormy Cells piece in the series with The Intercept. You begin this part by telling the story of two prisons affected by last year's Dixie Fire in California. Explain, if you could, what happened on these prison campuses.
Yeah, so we looked at a couple different places. One was the California Correctional Center, which is in this small rural prison community called Susanville. People incarcerated in this facility first noticed the impact of the fire, not only because of the smoke, but also because they lost power. So, starting in July, these power lines were impacted by the fire and the facility was supposed to be operating on generator power. The problem was, according to people incarcerated there, that the emergency generator was not working properly. So, by the time the Dixie Fire was getting even closer and really kind of threatening the community of Susanville, people had been stuck locked in their cells for more than a month with no lights. So, you know, they're literally in the dark. They don't know what's going to happen to them when the fires get closer. They're also inhaling a lot of smoke from the fires. And, in some cases, people said that they, had padlocks put on their door, because the locks are typically electronic. So, you know, they're asking. One guy said he asked a corrections officer what would happen if the fires got too close, and he just kind of laughed and said, "You guys will stay here." You know, I also heard that the ventilation and toilets would stop working for hours at a time. So it was just a really miserable, terrifying experience.
And you mentioned briefly the question by the incarcerated person to the guard, what would happen and what are the procedures? What struck me about what you wrote about is that there's just no ability to flee from these fires. Mm-hmm. They're going to keep them there until the last possible second. And it doesn't seem like these corrections facilities take a plan seriously on how to save these people's lives, especially because they're already treating them with such inhumanity in the first place.
Right. I mean, this is, I think, one of the most important things to remember about how the climate crisis impacts incarcerated people is that they're just totally reliant on the state to take care of them and to decide when they should get away from the thing that's causing, you know, safety issues. And of course, all these corrections departments say that they have plans, they have evacuation plans, emergency plans, but they won't share details. There's no transparency. You know, no one will share details because it's a security risk. And, you know, for people who are incarcerated and their families, that just doesn't make them feel very reassured, especially in the wake of or in the midst of the pandemic, where people really felt that they were not protected, not given vaccines and treatment and kind of quarantine procedures that would have been appropriate. There's just very little trust in this very untransparent system.
Are prison evacuations done well, even under best of circumstances, when there isn't a wildfire that could kill everybody involved.
Right. I mean, this is the thing. They don't, I mean, experts in, I guess, prisons and emergency management say that, like, it is a really, it's a logistical nightmare. You're moving at sometimes thousands of people at a time. You have to find a secure facility to put them. You know, the people that you're moving are considered security risks themselves. So, and, you know, I guess, quote unquote, criminals. So, a lot of times people end up in really kind of poor conditions, sort of facilities that haven't, sometimes facilities that haven't been used in a while. Sometimes, you know, in one case, I think it was in Oregon, in the last couple years, people were put in a facility, alongside, former fellow, like members of the same gang that they were no longer affiliated with. And, you know, they experienced retaliation. With COVID, it's been a huge problem with, there not really being, a lot of people are reporting that there haven't been a lot of efforts to separate people with COVID from the rest of the population when evacuations do happen. So it's just, it tends to not go well.
Yeah, I mean, the COVID conversation has been fairly well documented. And even that, given even COVID in general and how that's treated in prisons and detention facilities, is a climate change adjacent conversation in and of itself, because these pandemics are going to continue to happen with more frequency the more that we encroach, and the wildlife populations mix with the human populations and these diseases begin to proliferate. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the data, because we don't have the map here, but The Intercept did a bunch of, and this is so people can go check out your piece, these really intricate maps of where these facilities are even located. What are some of the percentiles in terms of the location of detention facilities in high-risk wildfire areas?
Sure. So, you know, I mean, we focused a lot on California in our reporting. And I think we found that about a fifth of jails, prisons, detention centers in California are in above the 95th percentile for wildfire risk in the nation. That facility we talked about, California Correctional Center, is in the 90th percentile for wildfire risk. You know, but it was also pretty interesting to see that it's not just California facing a lot of risk. You know, certainly Idaho and some other states in the West have a large proportion of their facilities facing, extreme risk. But we also found a ton of facilities in Florida, that have, elevated wildfire risk. I think we looked at some of the largest facilities in the nation facing really high wildfire risk, and we noticed that the Everglades Correctional Institution has very high risk. And you know, it's, you hear that name and you think of like water, and you wouldn't imagine that wildfires would be a problem. But actually, there have been two or three fires over the last decade that have come close to the facility and raised alarms. So, you know, I think we are seeing, the fires get so big and intense in California and the Pacific Northwest, but really they're getting worse everywhere. So I think it's something that places that don't think about it now will have to more.
You mentioned Florida there, and I guess that's a good way to transition into one of the thirds of your piece here, one of the three parts, the trapped in the flood section, with floodwaters rising, prisoners wait for help in floating feces. Okay, that paints a picture, and that's exactly what happened in one of these Florida detention facilities that are definitely at risk of increased risk of flooding. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in Florida's detention facilities.
Yeah, so we identified more than 50 facilities in Florida with kind of major to extreme flood risk, according to our scale. And one of them with severe flood risk is called the Cross City Correctional Institution. And this facility is located in Dixie County, which flooded pretty miserably this summer. After Hurricane Elsa, rain just kept pouring and the county kind of turned into a lagoon. Really, it got minimal national media attention. Nobody really noticed that this was happening. It's a pretty low income rural area, and it relies on this prison for a lot of its economy. And of course, there were many, many people there kind of suffering. And so, you know, at first visitation hours were canceled, which are kind of can be a lifeline for a lot of people who are incarcerated. But later, you know, we talked to this guy, Deron Jones, who said that at one point, water started kind of like coming up through the sewage system. And he sat in his cell for hours with ankle deep water with, you know, human waste floating in it. He said that they were fed, in this condition. And eventually, you know, later that day they were evacuated, but versions of this have happened in a number of places. I think the Orleans Parish Prison during Hurricane Katrina is the most extreme example where people are in like chest deep water. But U.S. Penitentiary Beaumont has repeatedly had really poor conditions after hurricanes. A lot of times, you know, not having the kind of ventilation and functioning toilets that people should expect. And so, yeah, it's kind of this issue of flooding and storms impacting prisons and jails can be considered chronic, I think.
And it seems like this is also a direct result of DeSantis's neglect in the state of Florida, that there's a huge number of prison guard positions that are unfilled. And one, I mean, I'm in favor of ending mass incarceration. I believe we should have many, many less prisons, except for in extreme examples. But if you're going to have these prisons and you're going to be responsible for these people's lives, the level of neglect that DeSantis has shown seems to be particularly acute.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite extreme. There's one Republican senator that's actually been really especially vocal on this, that, you know, I think something like a third of the corrections officer positions are open. So they're really operating without a lot. And that, you know, that really means that the people incarcerated inside have less freedom in a way. And, you know, there's also this huge backlog of maintenance issues. So in Florida, and a lot of these facilities are not air conditioned. So people are really suffering in Florida. And I think that system is facing a pretty acute crisis in more ways than one.
You talked about this, but I don't have the number in front of me right here. How many of these facilities are run by DeSantis himself and the state of Florida itself?
I don't have the number in front of me, but it is, I think, yeah, we identified around 50 in Florida in total, facing significant risk. DeSantis and the state of Florida, I think manages the largest proportion of that. And we found that Florida manages kind of the largest proportion of high flood risk facilities, compared to any other kind of agency or, yeah, I guess government entity. So Florida plays a big role here. And again, there's also this heat risk and wildfire risk there to take into account. Yeah, so they're facing a real crisis.
And now, speaking of Republican governors that are both cruel and incompetent, let's move to Texas, the boiling behind bars part of your special here. In sweltering Texas, prisons without air conditioning are about to get a lot hotter. Tell the story of Justin Phillips in your piece, who was living in an unconditioned cell in Texas during the 2018 heat wave.
Yeah, so Justin Phillips, his story is really kind of representative of the beginning of this grassroots movement for air conditioning in prisons in Texas. So Justin was diagnosed with this rare kidney condition just as right when he was first incarcerated, and very quickly was moved into the Cofield unit in Texas, which had no air conditioning. You know, he says that his condition really deteriorated over that time. His blood pressure medication made him ill when it was really hot. So at times he would skip doses. You know, there was also this issue of problems with the medical system in prison itself. He said a lot of times he wasn't escorted to take his other medications. And, you know, the experts we spoke to said that heat is really hard on the kidneys, especially when you have a condition as serious as Justin's.
Well, it dehydrates you, right? So it's you know, that's difficult.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, Justin's wife, Casey, really fought for him from outside, trying to get him removed from a situation that she really believed was going to kill him. And eventually through like many, many phone calls and emails, got him transferred out of the Cofield unit. You know, we looked at some temperature records from that time, or heat index records, and around the time he was transferred, there was a day when the heat index outside was recorded as 127 degrees. We don't know how hot it was inside, but it could have been hotter. So the heat really was extreme. You know, in the wake of this, Casey Phillips, Justin's wife, began really organizing around this issue and helped start this organization, Texas Prisons Air Conditioning Advocates, which is now Texas Prisons Community Advocates. They've really been a force advancing legislation around heat protections, which has not so far passed.
So Abbott, I didn't realize until reading this in your piece that he has been trying to stop air conditioning in prisons actively for years at this point, which is, I mean, it's impossible to fathom. But then you remember that this is the guy that went behind the podium and bragged about how many executions that he had presided over as governor of the state. How extensive has his role been in preventing the installation and infrastructure of air conditioning in some of these prisons?
Yeah, so he's played this very key role. I mean, back in 2011, there were a bunch of lawsuits it was after 2011. In the summer of 2011, a number of people died from heat-related causes. And a number of their family members filed lawsuits in Texas. Governor Abbott at that time was the attorney general. So he was in a position, his office was directly in this position to defend the state against these families that were saying that they were really being harmed by these problems. You know, fast forward to today, he's the governor and really plays a vital leadership role in deciding what kind of legislation his, will advance. So, this past fall, the most recent, air conditioning legislation that the organization I mentioned, introduced, it was during this special session where Governor Abbott was directly responsible for setting the agenda. You know, what he said kind of is what they would focus on this during the session, and you know, the legislation did not advance. They'd introduced it two other times, and it sort of failed to move. And now it'll be a couple years because Texas's legislature only meets every 2 years. It'll be 2023 before they really have a chance to fight for heat relief again.
How many of the facilities in Texas even have air conditioning?
So we, based on 2020 figures, we found that I think about a third had full air conditioning. These are state prisons. The jails are air conditioned. So about a third of state prisons had full air conditioning. Around 21 at that time had no air conditioning. Another 50 or so had partial air conditioning, which in some cases was like 100 beds in a massive facility. So there's really, you know, tens of thousands of people suffering in the heat in Texas.
Of the states that you were able to map, I mean, you highlighted three large states. Did you see a connection between the sheer number of facilities and also the lower standard of conditions that were provided in those facilities? The larger the state, the more prisons, the less likely that those prisons are going to not be vehicles of human torture and suffering.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can't say for sure that like Texas is treating its prisoners worse than Connecticut or something. We didn't quite do that kind of analysis, but we did think that those were good places to focus because of the scale of control that the state has over people. You know, these are massive state prison systems, and if a shift in their practices impacts the most people. They're also states that are sort of notorious for the climate impacts that they're facing. So it was sort of natural to focus on those places. But, you know, I would also say a place like New York would be really interesting to look more into. We spoke to a researcher who told us that, you know, in the Northeast, a 90-degree day, or, you know, 90-degree days can increase the mortality of incarcerated people by as much as 18%. So, you know, there's not the kind of acclimation in some of the states that we didn't focus on that there is in Texas or Florida, for example. So the issues kind of take different forms depending on where you are in the U.S.
Right. And another kind of, I guess, distinction I'm curious about, was there any data that you found that differed or showed different results between private prisons and ones that were run by the state, for example?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we're curious about. There, a lot of private facilities actually are not a part of our data set just because we relied on this very specific, I mean, albeit massive, list of like more than 6,500 facilities that the Department of Homeland Security put together. One of our kind of data partners on this, this carceral ecologies team at UCLA has identified, I think a few dozen private facilities that aren't in that DHS database. So we haven't been able to do that kind of comparison, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I'm very curious to see. And I mean, probably part of the reason that there even are private facilities is because they go under the radar in these large data sets. And it makes it harder for journalists like yourself to aggregate that, I'd imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I think also it's been hard. We identified ICE facilities within our data. But it just, you know, these contracts are constantly shifting and moving around. So it's hard. We had to be very clear about this being a snapshot as of 2020. Although, you know, I think it's still accurate for most of the facilities that we documented.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to reading a bit more of what you have to write over at The Intercept. Everyone, please check out the Climate and Punishment series. Check out the interactive maps and graphics there. There's also a video up that you'll be able to see. Aline Brown, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, we are going to take a quick break, come back, and then we will be diving a bit more into Ukraine. We are here with Jack Crosby of the AM Quickie and a writer at a variety of publications, including you recently had a piece in Rolling Stone about Ukraine, stationed in Ukraine. Thank you so much for coming to chat with us on short notice.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Emma.
Yeah, and I should say that I am now a regular reader of the AM Quickie. Everyone else should check it out as well, even though I technically don't have to because I do the news on my own here. But I like it so much that I got to read it.
It's a good thing to get. It's a good place to be.
Very well done.
Corey Pine has been taking over duties for me. We usually split it, but he's running the show now because I'm over here and the time difference is crazy, and I got some other things going on. But I'll be back on the Quickie hopefully in a week or so. We'll see.
Gotcha. All right. Well. Awesome. I mean, thanks again for doing this. You're on the ground in Ukraine. Just how are you? What's your sense of what you're seeing there? And just after Putin's dramatic escalation yesterday, I'd imagine tensions are amazingly high.
Yeah. So I'm in a city called Kharkiv right now. It is sort of in northeastern Ukraine. It's the second largest city in the country. It's right on the border with Russia. So this is one of the cities that's like kind of been a tension point in this crisis, because a large amount of Russia's like military buildup. This is basically the closest urban center in Ukraine to the Russian border. I flew in here. I spent some time in Kiev, speaking to people there, and did a couple of stories. I've mostly, as you said, been working for Rolling Stone on this trip. Did a few stories there, and then recently, just before we got to Kharkiv, we spent a couple of days down in the Donbas region, which is the region that's in the news now and has been for the past 8 years, because it was this is the site of the initial Russian invasion in 2014, and kind of the area that has been sort of propped up as these separatist republics, which are effectively Russian occupied territory and now are officially Russian occupied territory.
And in terms of the way that Putin has now made this public declaration, what effect does that have to people on the ground, the separatists, the groups of people that would rather be a part of Russia as opposed to in Ukraine? How much does that embolden those groups? And what's your sense of the split in the area that you're currently in?
Well, Kharkiv is a Russian speaking city for the most part. The language denominations don't really correspond to political opinions. And I think what I've learned, especially from reporting in areas that have like intimately experienced this conflict for the past 8 years or so, is that politics kind of blurs down there for a lot of these people. And what the vast majority of them want is just any sort of system that will give them a sense of stability, basically.
Right.
I think, sort of at the beginning of the conflict, there were a lot of these attempts to like define like certain cities in Ukraine as pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian or pro this or pro that and stuff like that. And I think you will find those people. There are certainly, there are always going to be people who are enthusiastic about politics one way or another, that are extremely pro-Ukrainian, that are extremely even pro-separatist. I think it's worth noting, though, that sort of before Russian intervention or invasion, as it I think can be classified, in 2014, there wasn't really like a flourishing separatist movement in these places. There were certainly tensions. I think it goes back a long way. These portions of Ukraine had sort of been economically depressed for a lot of years and had felt sort of isolated and cut off from the country and perhaps like not really as attended to by the government. So there was sentiment there, but there wasn't really a flourishing like separatist movement until it was essentially created as a result of the sort of ratcheting up of tensions for political reasons after Russia's annexation of Crimea et cetera, et cetera. So when you speak to people down there, yeah, I mean, when I was in Donetsk, the city under separatist control in 2015, you would find people that said, like, yes, we love the idea of Novorossiya, we want to be an independent republic, blah, blah, blah. You find those people just like you find people on the Ukrainian side who are, you know, hardcore Ukrainian nationalists. But the people most affected by the conflict really just, like, want people to stop blowing up their houses.
Right.
Whoever that is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and what's your sense on the ground of, and this is probably hard to delineate, but artificial involvement by both Russia and the United States in terms of, like, say, propping up a Ukrainian nationalist movement versus, and on the flip side, Russia now openly with Putin's proclamation, that's an obvious example. But prior to that, their involvement in the nationalist, or I'm sorry, the separatist movement in the eastern regions of Ukraine.
So, I mean, I guess we'll start with the much more sort of easy to identify one. You know, as I mentioned, the separatist movement in eastern Ukraine and the separatist government and the separatist militaries down there do not exist in basically any form without the direct involvement, support, armament, and, like, direct troop on the ground involvement of members of the Russian military. It has effectively been occupied territory for the past 8 years, and now it's officially occupied territory. Ukraine's, I guess U.S. involvement in Ukraine and what you're speaking of like Ukrainian nationalism, especially like far right elements in it and stuff like that, is a factor as well. It's something that we've seen throughout this conflict. When the conflict began in 2014, the Ukrainian military was very sort of like underfunded and unorganized. And this sort of like Russian backed separatist movement that was in a large part supported by, you know, Russian special forces and troops and things like that, made some like really serious advancements onto Ukrainian government territory really quickly. And what we saw at that phase of the conflict, that a lot of the people who were able to mount an armed response to that very quickly were these sort of Ukrainian ultranationalist groups that we talk about, like these ultranationalist militias and things like that, the Azov Battalion, the Aoun Battalion, that like a lot of these things that you know, leftists in the U.S. have been very concerned about for a long time, and for good reason. These were some of the first groups to really start fighting. And I think, you know, U.S. concerns or concerns among leftists that the U.S. is like funding and supporting these groups are definitely valid. I'm not sure that they're the best entry point into the conflict as it is currently, but I think it is something that we need to like very much keep an eye on.
Monitor.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, there's more to that, how like a lot of these battalions have sort of been folded into the Ukrainian, like the traditional Ukrainian military. They've sort of been absorbed into the National Guard, which is hugely problematic for obvious reasons, but it's also made it, it's also in some ways limited their sort of like reputational aspects as like the only ones that are fighting for Ukraine, right? Ukraine has sort of like homogenized its military more to where it's a more, a broader like nationalist effort rather than just like Ukrainian you know, nationalism comes in a lot of forms, I think, in a lot of countries. And in Ukraine, some of it, yes, is going to be extremely far right, and some of it is not. You know, there are plenty of liberals in Ukraine who feel very strongly pro-Ukrainian and Ukrainian nationalist, but that are not really in any way connected to the far right. Right.
So in terms of the way that the left in the United States has covered it, do you think that there's a bit, because, you know, a lot of us are looking at this through the lens of, like, say, post-Iraq war, or, you know, post-war on terror or current war on terror America, an overemphasis on, like, the far-right, basically fascist elements that had been propped up by the U.S. as opposed to the broader nationalism, where it's less, you know, centering of U.S. involvement, then that's probably an overemphasis, basically.
Yeah. I think in short, yes, exactly. I don't want to say that like leftists are wrong to focus on those right wing elements and things like that. I think it's also important to consider, and like not really to do whataboutism, but that the Ukrainian nationalists and the far right elements in Ukraine are definitely there, but Russia is also a far right government, far right, like explicitly imperialist, interventionist, far right regime. I don't think it's particularly useful to draw equivalencies between the Russian regime and the US regime and say like which one is like more right wing or something like that. But it is, I think what you're getting at here is that leftists in the United States and the leftist picture of the world has for so long been really focused, righteously so, on combating the effects and the overreach of U.S. imperialism throughout the globe, that I think sometimes that's caused a little bit of a blind spot to the fact that there are other malicious actors on a global scale, and that there are other far-right governments and far-right sort of interventionist systems that are not the United States. So, like, none of that lets the U.S. off the hook, right? But I think it does add additional context to these conflicts.
Well, you know, I'm not to make the comparison, but I'm going to make a comparison just really briefly, because when you hear Putin talk about Ukraine's trying to develop nuclear weapons, all right, that sounds a little like the United States. I mean, but independent of that, that's just really a transition. Can you talk about that claim and really the absurdity of it?
Right. I mean, this is one of the funniest. Well, it's not really funny because it could turn into a massive, hugely destructive war. But it's been interesting looking at how Putin has kind of like set up this intervention in Ukraine. And a lot, some people have noted that he's used certain tactics and things like that very closely mirror U.S. and NATO interventions in the Balkans and and in Kosovo and things like that. And he's set up, like, his pretext for war here is that he's sending in peacekeeping troops on a humanitarian mission to protect the civilians, brave, culturally Russian civilians of these breakaway republics. And I think, you know, it's the parallels definitely are there to, I guess the takeaway is that an explicitly imperialist regime is going to find an excuse for war and go to war no matter what anyone else does, right? And I think, you know, both the United States and Russia have done that, and we're seeing Russia do that in a way that doesn't even seem particularly concerned over how obvious it is. You know, they can just say anything and it doesn't really matter. They can say the nuclear weapons thing, and it's not, you know, these aren't, it's not aimed at a U.S. audience or anything like that. It's just aimed at giving them any kind of sort of plausible deniability or to curry domestic support, I think.
So I guess the get down to brass tacks question is what is the sense of the likeliness of war, as opposed to, say, these peacekeeping troops entering, there being an annexation, or, you know, there's already been a lot of bloodshed in eastern Ukraine, which I'm hoping you can touch on as well, since 2014. What is the sense of how likely the Russia's desires are going to be fulfilled?
I think it's incredibly likely. I think the variable that's most concerning right now is we have not been throughout most of this conflict entirely sure on what the extent of Russia's desires are. So to sort of expand on that, the practical question right now is whether or not Russia uses its military, which is has already entered these occupied regions of Ukraine, whether or not Russia uses its military to expand the pre-existing borders of those regions to the overall borders of those, they're called oblasts, but essentially states of Ukraine before the 2014 war. So what happened in 2014 is that there was this the war that sprang up through the Russian-backed sort of Russian proxies and the separatist group in these regions in the Ukrainian government. And the war went sort of back and forth for a long time in the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. Territory changed hands for a while. In about the middle of 2015, the front lines basically stabilized and haven't really moved since then. Those front lines, though, do not correspond to the original borders of those two oblasts, Donetsk and Luhansk. The regional authorities of these separatist republics, these Russian-backed proxies, claim ownership over the entire oblast of the two. So it'd be like, for instance, if like California and Oregon decided to secede together, right? And they fought a war with the U.S. government, and California and Oregon's like secessionist authorities ended up with like half of California and a scrap of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And then a third country came in and they said, we recognize your existence, not with your scrap of California and your scrap of Oregon, but with all of California and all of Oregon. And that's essentially what Russia has done today. I believe that Putin said, you know, we recognize their claim to the entire sort of like pre-war borders of these two oblasts, these two states within Ukraine. And we are willing to use Russian military force to support their claim to those borders. What that means in practice is if Russia does intend to find a justification for or move those existing front lines, is going to be enormously costly and destructive to human life and everything on a scale of something that we haven't seen in decades, I would say.
Yeah, and I mean, the Biden administration has said they're as much that they're not really interested in the ground war, especially on Russia's turf, which would not go well. But at the same time, there's not much in terms of deterrence, it seems like, that they can exercise. Already 14,000 people have died since 2014 in this internal civil battle in Ukraine. And I mean, the death toll would likely, I mean, I don't even want to speculate, but it would be incredibly bad if this were to obviously, if bloodshed were to be to happen, if blood were to be spilt, which Putin basically said as much yesterday in his speech. Do you still think, though, that this is a very elaborate, it could be a very elaborate and aggressive way for Putin to basically nudge the separatist areas into annexation without bloodshed? I mean, maybe that's me thinking, looking at this through rose-colored glasses, but that is... It seems like that could be possible to avoid more death.
It's certainly possible. I think that's honestly the solution that a lot of people, myself included, I would say, are sort of hoping for at this point. You know, the Russian government has had effective control over those regions since 2014. Basically, they could have formally annexed them at any time. They could have, they could have done this basically at any time. I think what's so concerning to a lot of people is the level of buildup on, Ukraine's other borders with Russia and borders with Belarus and things like that. It goes back to what I said, is that we don't. I think everyone right now is guessing basically at what. And I know it's a cliche to be like, what's in Putin's head? This is what, you know, that a lot of the liberal
We're going to look into his heart like Bush.
Exactly. Right. You know, like people have been obsessing over this for years and years and years. But what I think we've seen in the past couple of days in his control over even the sort of bureaucracy of his own government and in the speech that he made a couple of nights ago is that the decision making for what happens in this conflict is really basically coming solely down to him and what he decides. And so for me, I just don't know. There's I think a good chance that what he wants out of this is, and what he feels he needs to pursue for Russia's, you know, security concerns is outright regime change in Ukraine to get them back to a leader that effectively functions as, you know, as a proxy in a similar way that the leaders of Belarus and places like that do.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. I mean, he's doing that most likely because Ukraine is still not a part of NATO, even though there's that threat, but because it's also just a massive border share. It would be a huge territory to have and a huge ally in terms of just the size of the nation.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I'm definitely not one of the on Putin's mind experts or even really like a European security expert in general. But I think he did make it very clear in that speech the other night that he does not really respect the idea of Ukrainian sovereignty in any way. And so I think that discussion, goes back to like, how do we decide what a sovereign nation is? How do groups of people on this earth decide to differentiate themselves, and what does that make up? I think in the current system of world governance that we have, it's pretty hard to make a case that Ukraine as a nation does not deserve to have sovereignty and self-determination. But the question of NATO is obviously a lot more thorny than that. Ukraine very strongly wishes to join NATO, and NATO has essentially sort of held that as a threat toward Russia, but also prevented Ukraine from doing that because they know that it would be such a huge provocation. The reasons that Ukraine wants to join NATO are extremely clear because they're not in NATO and they have now been invaded twice. So I don't know if that's, I'm not going to come on the Majority Report and like make an art, like a extremely pro NATO argument that it should exist in the global system overall. Right. But the reality of the situation right now is that NATO does exist, a non-NATO affiliated country, but that is generally economically and politically inclined more with NATO states and the European Union, has been invaded in an overt imperialist hostile action by another state.
Well, Jack, I can't thank you enough for coming on, especially with such short notice. I think I've said that a few times, but it really was a huge help. And stay safe. Hope all is well, and everybody should check you out on Twitter, read your work, and I'm looking forward to reading what you're going to be putting out there for Rolling Stone, including to the piece that you already have up with them.
Yeah.
Jack, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Emma.
Yep. All right, folks, with that, we are going to head into the fun half, talk a little bit more about this, take your calls. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Oh yeah, Left Reckoning. Oh, I gotta change my headphones.
All good.
Left Reckoning, we had on the Jewish question, Karl Marx. We continued our reading series of early Karl Marx writings, and this is another one where he's taking on the members of the young Hegelians who are too focused on idealism in this case, religion, saying, and making anti-Semitic arguments, saying, hey, if Jewish folks want liberation, they need to first liberate themselves from their religion before we give them political votes. Marx was against that, so we talk about that. And the problematic part two of the essay where he traffics in some of the tropes, and we get into Marx's family history with converting from Judaism and that sort of thing. So
nuance.
Yeah, a lot of history that you might want to be interested in having at your fingertips in case, you know, people like Stefan Molyneux like to bring up the part two of On the Jewish Question to argue that Marx was simply like a Jew hater. And it's good to know actually the extent that Marx did traffic in bigotry and actually what he was saying in those essays. So patreon.com/leftreckoning for that.
All right. Well, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. Use the code majority, get 10% off. Did I do that right? I got to write that down. We're going to be taking your calls 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah! Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
You bring back DJ
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.